Hey folks, Sam Jones here. Welcome to another edition of Off Camera, the show where I get to talk to iconic, creative, curious artists and find out how they got that way. And in this episode, I talk to actress and playwright Danai Gurira. The talented and worldly Danai Gurira has been bridging the gap between disparate worlds ever since her family moved from Grinnell, Iowa, all the way to Africa when she was 5 years old. In school, the Zimbabwean American, or Zamerican, as she calls herself, was the African kid with the twangy American accent who got along with everybody, regardless of race and class. That ability to cross both artistic and geographic borders has defined Danai's career. On the blockbuster side, she inhabits the character of Okoye in the Marvel film Black Panther, and the character of Michonne, the butt-kicking zombie killer, in AMC's hit series The Walking Dead. And on the literary side, she's a playwright with Broadway success who mingles with the highbrow theater crowd. But don't get caught up in Western delineations between actor and writer, because at her core, Danai is a storyteller, a woman who uses her unique perspective and artistic talent to reveal the shared humanity between seemingly different worlds of Africa and America. Danai points out that talent must be nurtured and distractions must be set aside, because the whole goal of storytelling is to become a worthy enough vessel for the story to come through you. Danai joins us to discuss the nuanced world of Ryan Coogler's Black Panther, auditioning for The Walking Dead, overcoming grad school breakdowns, and discovering her artistic mandate. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Danai.
Hi, Sam.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
You know, you are our first Zimbabwean American.
There are not many of us, actually.
Well, look, you are a very unique individual, not only in your heritage, but also in the fact that it's almost like you have these two disparate identities in the art world, too. Because on one side, you have this massive Comic-Con blockbuster following through The Walking Dead and through also Black Panther. And on the other side, you're this kind of high art Broadway playwright. and from the outside, it looks like, being from two countries that, you know, don't often
overlap.
Yeah. Overlap. But from where you sit, is the connection more obvious to you, or does it seem that dissimilar for you to have those two worlds that you live in?
It can. It can feel dissimilar. When there are moments of overlap, it's quite nice.
Like, yeah.
I know, I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, but the head of the public theater, which of course is very highbrow art,
yes.
One of my plays was just done in the last year or two. He loves The Walking Dead, so that's like
really?
This great overlap between that and that, those worlds. And then there are heads of other theaters who are like, so when are you going to be done with this whole acting with the sword thing I hear you're
right.
doing, you know, and come and like workshop one of your plays with us again, you know? So it's a very interesting overlap and slash complete disparity at the same time. But yeah, for me, it just feels like I don't know how to be anything other than what I am, I guess. So it's just when it's described back to me, I realize how kind of nutty or unusual it sounds.
Right.
And honestly, the one part that I never imagined was the Walking Dead Marvel component of my life. I never imagined that.
Well, how could you imagine that?
Yeah, that's true, right? I was always just planning on telling African women stories and doing a lot of theater, and that was
right.
kind of my plan. But then, you know, like I went to Tisch for grad acting, and so you get an agent, and they send you out for film and TV work. You're like, oh, yeah, okay, I'll go
that's
in for that.
Part of the deal, yeah.
No, that even crossed my mind initially. But yeah, then I started to go into auditioning for TV and film. And literally, Walking Dead, I was moving here to Los Angeles to really focus on starting to write for the screen, actually. But then right at that moment, Walking Dead came along. And I was in Atlanta, and I was shooting this TV
right.
show 7 months a year. So, and everything changed. So it was interesting. It's always like, I always feel like my acting creeps up on me. And my writing, I plan out, and my acting creeps up on me.
Interesting.
Yeah, but it's always like exactly what I never knew I always wanted. That's kind of what happens with me in acting, because I didn't, you know, I'm very particular about the roles I will do, because I think that it's a grand investment to give yourself to a television show and
yeah.
or to a franchise, and it's a big investment. And for me, I'm always like, well, it has to make sense to me.
in a way that's not like, oh, it's a job. It has to go far beyond that. Also because, you know, I do have, you know, that also strong connection to creating works on the page. And there's been some very interesting moments of the overlap, and both sides have been very accommodating. When my play Eclipsed was on Broadway at the same time, my play Familiar was off Broadway. The Walking Dead was so supportive and accommodating my needs to go back and forth to New York, and you know, and a lot of them came and watched the plays, and so it's really it's been fortunate that way. But I will say, even though I went to school for acting and I am very much an actor, I do sometimes feel my acting crawls up on me, whereas my writing is always planned.
Well, it's funny because it seems like in your case, one success has begat another, and I would think there could be some nervousness about this one kind of success, like The Walking Dead leading into Black Panther. It's almost like, be careful what you wish for, because those opportunities are so amazing, but at the same time, you only have one life and you have to choose where to put your time. Do you ever think about that, or is there a master plan to sort of these big blockbuster type things?
I'd love to say there was a master plan that was very specific like that. But yeah, really all I do is I do my heart check. Like when I was approached to do Black Panther, I was shocked and amazed and was like, really? And I couldn't even believe it was happening. I was like, they're just offering me a role in Black Panther, what? And then I met Ryan Coogler, and he hadn't even seen Walking Dead.
Really?
He'd never seen it.
So do you see this world where those two things are getting closer together, where
yes,
we do have these tentpole blockbuster films, but they're inhabited by independent-minded people?
And, you know, you have to give that credit to, you know, the heads of Marvel and places like that, where they see the power and the ability in those small, intimate films and bring those guys in as helmers, you know?
Right.
And that's really exciting because he's, like, very, very... He did create the world with intricate intimacy and allowed us in as great collaborators. And that really allowed an ownership and a lot of heart and guts and soul to go into what we were doing on set every day.
And did that surprise you when you got the script and you started to go through it?
No, because I think from the get-go, when with him helming it, it just set a tone. And sitting down across from him and hearing his vision and hearing what he'd written and what he was thinking about and how the world worked and why it worked this way and all the amazing components of real African cultural representation he was pulling from with great specificity and awareness. I mean, I was just sold. Because a big thing for me of my pursuit as an artist is to tell stories from the African perspective and tell them with a great range of specificity and complexity. And he was totally on it. He was completely on that. And I thought that was really exciting to be able to play an African woman on the Marvel scale. I mean, that to me, it was just like nothing. It was a severe no-brainer.
Right. And I would guess that would give you larger expectations about your own work, about the size it could be, or the audience it could have.
I guess so. Like, it's interesting because, like, for me, it's always like I guess I don't think like that immediately. It takes a really long time for me to even think like that because I'm honestly thinking about telling the story, and that's the thing that's going to engage me and fulfill me.
Right.
Is like, am I telling a story that I want to tell? Am I fully engaged in getting this character on the screen with as much integrity and complexity and preparation as possible? And so that's kind of where my mind is like really getting into, you know, the making of the thing.
I would think it would expand the horizons for what kind of audience you could reach, both by doing The Walking Dead and by being involved in a Marvel franchise, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's so funny because it really only hit me the scale. You'd think, you know, there was, you know, such an amazing response to the trailer, you know. It was like, oh my gosh, there's an audience for this film, you know. Like,
yeah.
The trailer response was amazing, and it's just continued to be so. But it was actually when I went back to Zimbabwe, like, that I realized the scale that...
Oh, do people recognize you there?
Yeah, I could go nowhere. I was like, really? Because the last time I was here 2 years ago, this was not happening.
Now, do they get The Walking Dead in
Zimbabwe?
They
do.
They do.
It was that too, but there was a lot of excitement around Black Panther. A lot. of excitement.
It's like San Diego Comic-Con in Zimbabwe.
Yeah. It's very real. It was very, and they were very engaged and aware and had been connected to Marvel for a long time and were very excited about this. And so I that's kind of, when I realized I could go actually nowhere without being approached and selfies and all that. And I was like, wow.
How does that fandom worldwide and the realization that you can't go anywhere, how does that affect you, like, just on a personal level?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting because, I mean, thankfully, I only really started to deal with anything like a big franchise when, you know, I was in my 30s, like, you know, just now, like, in the last few years. So it's not, so I've been myself for a really long time.
Right.
So it wasn't something that molded me. I still really looked, and because as a playwright too, and even as an actor too, I do a lot of person-to-person research with various people. So I never want to feel separate, like separate from people, and or you know, disconnect from just being around people. So if fine, if you recognize me, fine. We're still going to have a normal conversation. So I brought one of my buddies who was in my play Eclipse, and she just came with me to Zimbabwe on an absolute whim, and we were sitting in this sort of lounge place, and it was like, you know, it was a kind of a stream of people coming, you know, at us here and there. But, you know, she was like, I love how you're handling this. And I was like, well, there's just no way I'm going to not relate to people. I'm interested in people. You know what I mean? Fine, take your picture, but I want to have a chat. Like, and I'm still going to learn some interesting stuff from you and maybe you from me. But, you know, I insist that I retain absolute utter connection and accessibility.
Right. Well, okay, so I have to ask, when you originally got the audition for Walking Dead,
mm-hmm.
and you sort of looked at the scope, because the show was on for a couple years at that point.
Yes.
I was just curious what it took for you to say, okay, I'm going to sign up for 7 years.
You know, it's interesting you asked that because, it's a very, the push-pull between being a writer and an actor. A year before Walking Dead came along, there was another TV show that I don't think is still on, and it was a kind of a cop show, and it was in like a pilot mode.
Right.
And I was being approached, literally, it was at that point where they're like, you pretty much have it if you, like, you know, if you sign the contract. And I was not feeling it enough to do that. And I was like, this is 7 years, this is possibly 7 years at least. And I don't have, I had another play coming out. This was around 2011. So I said, my play's coming out.
Right.
And it was going to have a rolling world premiere across three states and three great theaters. And I would not be available to help birth it if I was completely contracted to this TV show and what it needed from me. And it was not a TV show that really intrigued me, nor did the character seem to have anywhere to go or anything to do. But it's a TV job.
Right.
So that's supposed to be, you know, the quan.
And you have the agents going.
Yeah, exactly.
You should take this.
Right. So I literally had to, I came to a decision. I was like, I can't do it. I can't sign this contract. I can't do it. I can't do that to my play. I can't do that to the artistic directors who invested in my play. And this is not worth doing that to it.
How hard was that decision?
It wasn't that. I made it quite quickly because it was so clear to my heart. But the hardest part was telling my people, especially the ones who'd really invested in me.
Right.
And, like, I remember I was kind of bawling to my manager, because I'm like, I'm sorry, I'll make you money one day. I swear I'll make you money one day. And he's like, no, you know, did I fine? Don't cry. You know, men can't stand here and won't cry. But I was crying because I really felt bad, because he works hard for me. And I knew that, like, there's no check involved in my theater work, you know? And I just was like, I know that, you know, you work really hard for me. And, you know, and he was like, don't cry. He was like, I respect you. And so it was very sweet. You know, they accepted it. But, like, it was a big deal because it was, like, it was a guaranteed big check.
Yeah.
For 7 years. But then a year later, along came something I was willing to sign for.
Which was The Walking Dead.
Exactly. Which I would not have been available for had I signed that other contract.
Isn't that funny? That's so often the story, that a big opportunity comes around and you have this crisis of how do you pass up the money or how do you... And then when it bears out, it proves that you have to stick with your gut instinct what.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you do have to learn to say no, right?
Because yeah. I mean, I think it's the most powerful word artists have, because you are then you're defining your own path. And really, if you are an artist, you have a vision. You have vision of where you want to go, what you want to contribute, and you know you're not just being brought around like a product to be seen. You're aware of where you're trying to go to at least a pretty great extent. And so the idea of knowing how to say no to things that you do not feel align with that, and they don't make sense to your heart and where you're trying to go, you know, it can be hard because it can be big things you're saying no to. But
yeah.
it, you know, and at the time I did seem a little nutty, but they all understood ultimately, this is who she is. We know this is who she is. Why we won't fret. We trust that something else will come along. And something else did 12 months later. And quite literally, the reason why I love The Walking Dead is something to do. I hadn't watched it because I'm a scaredy cat. And I watched it to rehearse my auditioning and what's the tone of this show. And I just loved it. It wasn't a genre TV show to me at all. And I was totally taken. I loved the actors. I was like, how many of these guys are from theater? Like, there was just something about how they were working that just felt so rich and like, egoless and just really connected to telling the story well. And that's like, I was like, I want to hang in that. Like, that's somewhere I'd want to hang and want to do all that. You know, I want to do all that. And it looked all gritty and, you know, intense and, you know, people were doing crazy stuff and getting really grimy and disgusting and dirty and, you know, living on the edge. I was like, yes, I just wanted it. And then the other side of it was, the character, she was in the comic book, so I had an idea of her.
Right.
And I could see that she was very interesting and very complex and like nothing I'd ever seen. As a writer, I was like, I would never have thought of this chick, like, you know, dreadlocks and a sword and, you know, self-made army. But this one of my plays was about women in the army, I mean, in rebel armies, rather.
Right, Eclipsed.
Right, in West Africa. And I'd done a lot of research there, and I was like, wow, it's kind of like she's kind of like those women. So to me, how I related to the Walking Dead world was how it felt like a war zone to me. It felt like how, you know, when I learned about what happened in Liberia, when I went there, you see the devastation of war. You see literally how institutions and structures and social norms, everything just goes out the window. And it's just like everybody is on a whole different level of survival.
So when you get the call to audition for that, did you put yourself on tape or did you come in the room?
No, I came in. The awesome Sharon Bialy, you know, right here in LA.
Sure.
She'd seen me in 2006, and she just has this Rolodex of actors that she's like, I'm going to get you a role one day. You know, like, she's like that. And she's
right.
Amazing, and she's very much into theater. And so she called me in, and she said, she was like, I think this is it.
Well, I'll tell you, I've sat in a lot of auditions because I've directed some TV, and you know, they're the worst rooms ever because it's a blank wall and a desk and nine people eating lunch. And you know, that works for most scenes. You could sit down with someone as your scene partner
right.
and you can get through a scene. But I imagine that this would have been a totally different experience because your character is not only so intense but so physical. And especially the first season, there wasn't a lot of dialogue there.
No, there wasn't.
So how do you audition for such a physical role that required so much, almost required so much acting in an environment?
I mean, they created a scene that they create scenes. It's not gonna, because you know, Walking Dead is so top secret. So they didn't even on my contract, it didn't say my actual character's name.
Your entire career is secrecy. Like, no one can see a Marvel film before it comes out and you can't talk about anything. You're going to end up in jail if you say the wrong thing.
It was so funny when I got into the Marvel franchise. I was like, oh, I know this story. I got you.
I know how to do this.
But yeah, it's funny. But yeah, so basically they gave me the scene that was never enacted, which was great, actually, because it was just for them to see intensity, emotionality, everything. So it wasn't what you see in the first season, because they needed to see what you were capable of, like the whole gamut of it. So.
Right.
But it was great, because it really allowed you to show, it, like, to figure out the range of the character and to figure out where to enact it and how and who she was, what she was about. And I don't know, she just became very clear to me. And I think, you know, when they started writing her in through season three specifically, the idea that she was not a talker was something that was decided on, which I wasn't thrilled about. I sat down, the writers were like, she's not going to talk much. And I was like, oh, God. I like talking. Like, I mean, I'm a, you know, when I write, I like to create monologues. I like giving actors stuff to do.
But I did love how it was a very interesting challenge for me because her monologue was internal. It was driven by a lot of fear, actually, that came out as a ferocity and a cutoffness. And
armor.
Exactly. Armor. And that was an interesting thing to play. It was fascinating, actually, to play that. Very different from me. So it was very interesting.
How did you wrap your head around that at first? Once you sort of swallowed the pill of she doesn't talk much, did it create any anxiety or fear about how am I going to do this? Or did you discover a way to prep for her that ended up working?
You know, one of the ways I used, which was, it's going to sound crazy, but I did really go into research that paralleled the horrors of the world. That was real.
What do you mean?
I do a lot of research on human rights abuses and things like that that actually enrage me and really impassion me to write in a specific way about those stories and giving people voice that never get it. Like, that's what really drives me. And so connecting to that type of passion and rage inside of me, actually, it connects to how I allow a character to have a lot of I thought she had a lot of PTSD going on.
Right.
A lot of pain and turmoil going on that a lot of people have to deal with and never express in the
real
world.
So did you research how people with PTSD behave?
Oh, yeah, big time. And it's important to me to connect to true human experiences. Of course, that's my job.
Hey folks, Sam Jones here, and I want to talk to you a little bit about this week's sponsor, Ring. And I want to say that the companies that sponsor this show, we use their products, and we wouldn't have a sponsor on here if I didn't think it was a good product. And that goes for Ring, which is a company that we've watched since their inception. They started right here in Santa Monica, and as a matter of fact, their offices are very close to our studio, and they are making great products. And if you love the show and feel like supporting us, I highly recommend you go check out Ring, and I'll tell you at the end of this how to put in the off-camera code and check this company out because they're creating a really simple way to feel safe about your home. All right, now I'm going to tell you all about them. Their mission is to make neighborhoods safer. Today, over 1 million people use the amazing Ring video doorbell to help protect their homes. Ring knows home security begins at the front door, but it doesn't end there. So they have this new thing. They're extending that same level of security to the rest of your home with the Ring Floodlight Cam. Just like Ring's amazing doorbell, Floodlight Cam is a motion-activated camera and a floodlight that connects right to your phone with HD video and two-way audio that lets you know the moment anyone steps on your property. You can see and speak to visitors and even set off an alarm right from your phone. With Ring's Floodlight Cam, when things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what it is. And hopefully it's not a skunk, because we had one of those at our house the other night, and let me tell you, those things stink. Whether you're home or away, the Ring Floodlight Cam helps you keep an eye on your home from anywhere. With Ring, you're always home. So now here's the call to action. And please, if you like our show and you're thinking about upping your home security, this is what you do. You can save up to $150 off a Ring security kit when you go to ring.com/offcamera. That's ring.com/offcamera. So go there, do that, check them out, and tell me about your experience. Send me an email. Let me know that you heard about Ring on the show and that you tried them out. You'll be supporting Off Camera, and you'll know if there's any predators or skunks or weirdos in your yard. And your FedEx packages won't be stolen. So it's a win-win. Check them out, ring.com. And now back to the show.
So hearing you say all of this, do you think you're a writer first or an actor first?
Generally, what I'm doing is it sounds ridiculous, but I'm looking at it from the mindset of a storyteller because it's probably something that the great Ron Van Loo, he's an acting teacher who was at NYU Tisch, he said, you know, read a script for the first time just with a childlike sense of attention. You know, so you're not looking at it going, where's my line? Or you're not looking at it going, what happens? You know, you're looking at it like, I just want to enjoy this as a story. And take it in like a story, like something like when a child is reading their nighttime story and their eyes get big when they see that thing. And then, oh no, what's going to happen next? You know, and they're that engaged, you know. That's how I try to pick up a script and read it, first off.
Like a child. I love that description.
Yeah,
Did your parents read to you? As a kid?
Well, they expected me to read. I'm the child of academics. My mother's a librarian. So our house was
inundated with every type of book, from Judy Blume to James Baldwin. And it was very much like, read the books in this house. There are plenty of them. And I shipped them from Grinnell, Iowa to Harare, Zimbabwe. So read them.
Yeah. Okay, well, tell me about that. Tell me, how old were you when you moved?
I was 5.
You're 5 years old. Why did your parents move to Zimbabwe?
A lot of folks did that when Zimbabwe became independent. When countries like Barack Obama's father did it, when Kenya became independent. You know, it's like you kind of felt like you're in a certain degree of exile. They all came here in the 60s, right around kind of the Kennedy era. A lot of institutions started bringing Africans here for university. So that sort of a thing was something you did. You came here. Unfortunately, a lot of those African countries started to go, well, specifically mine, Southern Africa started to go into very turmoiled times.
Right.
You know, they couldn't go home. So just like them, the minute independence came, you wanted to go home, you know, and help build your new nation. And so my parents' independence came in 1980, and we went back end of 1983.
Do you remember being old enough to have an opinion about moving back?
You know, you're a kid. You can adapt so easily.
Yeah.
I adapted into Zim so easily. It was, you know, Zim was, you know, very, very modern African nation. And
right.
So I grew up around a very, very diverse crowd of people. And of course, Zimbabwe is racially diverse as it is. You know, as I said, like that's where the white population settled, like for the last 150, 200 years, and Indian population, and, you know, there's an Asian population that's very present there now. And so it's always been a very culturally diverse, racially diverse place.
So when you were a kid, did you feel the need or the pressure to identify as either American or African? Or
I always felt my little American thing. I always thought, like, I had my little twangy accent.
And was that an issue?
I was very much an African kid at the same time. Well, some people understood it, and there were other kids kind of like me, but then you're kind of a weirdo at the same time, but not in any crazy way, because I was a jock, and I was very talkative, so I was a cool kid. I wasn't in the corner, but it's not like American schools. When I watched TV shows or movies about American high schools, I'm like, what is going on in those things?
You know? How is it different?
Oh, the cliques, and you know, the whole, like, the jog, the cheerleader, the goths, you know, all the groupings that seemed to happen in American high schools. We don't really have that. Also because we also are not wearing our own clothes. We're all in uniforms.
Right.
And that eliminates a lot of things. And we also are generally in single-sex schools. That also eliminates a lot of things.
Well, so how did you discover performing in the arts?
It was actually a few things, but the key thing was I was in this family that lived down the road from us. The father was a professor of arts and professor of really English and dramatic arts at the University of Zimbabwe, but he created something called Chipawa, which is Children's Performing Arts Workshop, and kind of, you know, I was kind of recruited in there to be one of the pioneer members, you know, and we were learning traditional dance, we were learning how to, you know, sing certain songs, you know, so it was actually all of that, but also we were creating pieces of work that were relevant to the day.
So you weren't getting an Americanized version where they were showing you American films and television shows?
No. We had that, though. I mean, that's when you went to the movies in Zimbabwe, you were watching American movies. When you turned off, you watched a lot of American television.
Okay.
So we had tons of that exposure. But he was not interested in that at all. And he was very much, because he was really also a professor of the dramatic arts, you know, I learned a lot of the reverence you have to have around the craft and how much work it takes. I learned the work ethic at that point, which is when I was like 12, 13.
And your parents being academics, did they have a respect for theater and the arts and acting?
Yeah, they did.
They
just didn't like picking me up and dropping me off from rehearsals. that they could do without. But no, yeah, my parents are all about pursue, you know, my dad, Grinnell College, like it's a liberal arts college, like it's like pursue what you enjoy. And to believe that it mattered, you know, because it's like, you know, I remember debating things with my dad when I was 15, and it was great. We'd debate, you know, have a conversation, have your own thoughts, bring out your perspective, bring out why, you know. And that was something that, you know, I was always having very intense conversations with people 3-4 times my age.
Really?
You know, yeah, it was like when I'd enjoy people older than me coming to my house so I could, you know, hash out an issue. You know, that was kind of how I grew up. And, you know, it was kind of what was encouraged by my parents, which was very unusual. We were very unusual that way in Zimbabwe, to have this very talkative young girl.
And when did you kind of know, okay, I want to do this. I want to perform. I want to be on stage. And, like, when did you realize that was a thing you could do?
In college, I was definitely engaged in theater, but it wasn't what I thought I was going to do.
Right, because you went back to the United States for college.
Yes.
Was that always the plan?
Always.
Always
my parents
plan.
Went to the United States, you know, when during the 60s, and we were all born here. So it was kind of like, of course you're going to go back and go to liberal arts college in the United States. That's what we do. That's what the gurudas do. And they'd all gone, all my siblings had gone and done that. So, yeah.
Interesting. Totally, so you went to McAllister, right?
I went to McAllister.
And is that in Minnesota?
It is. It's in St. Paul, Minnesota. Yeah.
And okay, so you go back to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. You're not really African or American. You're both. You're mm-hmm. like.
It was weird.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I didn't get a host family because they're like, oh, but you're American born. But I was like, yeah, my parents are in Africa, though. Can I get a host family? So finally I got a host family. Like, and my friend who I went to high school with in Zimbabwe, one of my besties, still is, she came and she had this awesome host mother. And I was like, why can't I have a host mom? They're like, Tafanza, like, I want a host mom. You know, so I finally got one in, like, my senior year. I was like, oh, thanks. Finally
they were
giving
like,
me a host
she's
mom.
Fine.
She's fine. She was born here. I'm like,
you were like, I left
anything.
When I was five.
Exactly.
I don't know anything either.
Exactly. And literally, the year, the month, when I got back, I was in college. So it's not like I had time to acclimate and become American again, you know?
It's funny. I would think that students would make assumptions about you that were probably off.
All the time, various people do and did. And but the thing that I kind of was always able to do was to just attach and connect with various groups. So when I was in high school, you know, the white girls were sitting over here, the ones that were really involved in sports at least, and then kind of the nerdy ones sitting over there, the ones who just didn't really do sports or anything like that. They just kind of read books and chatted. And then the Indian girls and the girls who were more Middle Eastern were sitting over there. And then the, you know, the black girls were in their various cliques. And I could just hang with any of them. I just knew how to bop around anywhere. And if
really?
There were, like, you know, conflicts going on, I'd be like, okay, guys, come on out. I always be this, like, mediator. And I have no idea where that came from, but I just, you know, I have no problem hanging out with various different types of folks.
So did your college, was it a big international recruiting type of
yes,
school?
Yes, it is actually the biggest international recruiting school, I think.
So that's their thing.
That's their thing.
They create a community that's totally.
Absolutely. Very focused on that.
Right.
Big time. So, you know, I was always around various people from all over the world, you know, from just everywhere. And from Peru to Bangladesh, you know, all still my really good friends today. So, like, that type of experience was something that I loved. But, like, you know, there was a lot of interaction that was very across racial, cultural lines, you know. Always, like, the experience of dating someone out of your race for the first time always happened at that college, you know.
I would imagine, yeah.
Oh, yeah, every type of, and it was great. It was so great. You just saw all the sort of any barriers that might have been wherever in one's life just totally got melted down in this college. But I think I was very much connected to African Americans in terms of the specific plights happening domestically for them when I first got to college. And Africans are very laid back about their plights. They're like, oh, we're good, we're fine, we're from Africa, we have a lot of us around, you know, we know our ancestral traits, you know, dating back wherever, you know what I mean? There's that laid backness that Africans can express. But there are struggles that, you know, once I went back to Zimbabwe and then South Africa for study abroad, that's when I realized I want to tell African stories from an African perspective. And I started to focus more on the fact that I was indeed an African woman. And it was connected very much to how I felt very connected to the African-American struggle as well. But it started to become a thrust for me to really want to dismantle how misrepresented I felt and distorted I felt the African impression was to the rest of the world.
Interesting.
And that was when I was in South Africa for a semester abroad called Arts and Social Change. And it was not long after apartheid ended. And I'd been around so many artists who used their art to tell stories that affected how apartheid was being expressed and being, you know, used. They were using their art to inform the world about what was going on. And then I felt like I had no excuse because I was going to go into psychology. But then I realized your passion, Danai, is obviously in the arts. So
when
stop
you came
it.
To college, you picked something that you felt was more made more sense from an academic standpoint, and then your passion took over.
Yeah. It was, yeah, I mean, literally, I was spending a good amount of time running away. And I'd gone through a really rough year. One of my best friends had in Zimbabwe had died in a car crash, and I couldn't go home. And I was breaking up with my first college boyfriend, and you know, who was Swedish.
Of course he was Swedish.
So like there was just a lot of stuff going on for me that year. And also like I was getting very like kind of specifically sort of held in the idea of you're gonna go into a PhD program in social psychology. I had this fantastic mentor. I was like, okay, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. But there was something, then he sent me to a summer program, and it was really there when I was working with these experts in this area. And I was just like, I needed a play. Like, you know, I was like, I have got to go work on something artistic. What am I doing every day? Going to this building and doing this stuff, you know what I mean? And I just couldn't, I couldn't find my passion in it anymore. And that led directly into me going to South Africa for that semester abroad. I needed to figure out what was going on in South Africa the whole time I was growing up, and I couldn't set foot to that country because of apartheid. I need to really crack that open for myself. What is this country that was right next door all those years, and I couldn't go near it? My white classmates would go and come back with all types of goodies.
Right, they'd go see Table Mountain, and they'd...
Yeah, and in South Africa, you know, it's always had, like, its industrial stuff is, like, on point. Its infrastructure is amazing. So they'd come back with all types of things you can't get in Zim,
right.
Like candies and, like, cool stuff, like their pencil cases for their, like, school, you know, all that stupid stuff. But as a kid, you're like, man, we don't get those here, you know, and I can't go to that country and
you
get them myself.
You had envy for,
yeah, but it's just like, it was just that part of that separation, because as black people, we could not go and shop in South Africa, you know, and that's what I grew up with. It was this country right next door, all these bad things were happening, but apparently it was a really good time for my white classmates to go and get stuff and have fun, you know, and it was weird. And I was like, I gotta go investigate that country. I've never been. And I need to understand it now that I'm in college and I get an opportunity to study things. And so I went and I wanted to go to their Durban program, which was all about political stuff. And then that program was full. And they said, you have to do the Cape Town program, which is arts and social change. I'm like, oh, what? No, dang it. All right, fine. And there I am at Cape Town, the most beautiful cities in the world. I mean, like, there I am, like, going, oh, man. You know, I just didn't think it was going to be rigorous enough. Arts.
You were serious.
Yeah. I wanted to get into the depths of all the political, you know, stuff going on and what, you know, how it broke down from apartheid to now and where we were now and, you know, and really connect with the folks who are now at the front lines of transforming this nation, you know, politically. That's where I wanted to go. I was like, arts and social change. Oh, come on. And so I go and do this, and then I get to meet all these amazing artists who had used their art to fight apartheid. And then that thing that I'd been feeling started to really, like, swell in me. Like what am I doing with myself? Like, because I knew, like, I was very, and I'd been very involved in theater at McAllister. I just was like, that's not going to be my major, though.
That's fun.
Yeah,
and that's fun. I'm doing
that,
but I'm not, it's not serious
enough. But I'm not going to do that.
Right.
And it was really when I met all those artists. They were poets, they were photographers, they were actors, would use their art specifically in the theater, you know, to change the landscape of how the world could no longer ignore what was happening in South Africa. That really, those guys, it just hit me so hard studying them and learning about them. And I was like, so I literally sat down. The University of Cape Town was our house to university, and it's embedded in Table Mountain, like embedded. Like there's lower campus, middle campus, upper campus. It's all embedded in this astounding mountain. And I sat somewhere in middle campus, which, you know, you really get a workout at this university, by the way.
Like the stairs.
Oh, God. Like you're climbing a mountain to get from, like, you know, where you eat to where you go to the professor's departments. And so basically I was sitting in middle campus, and that's when I had that moment. I was like, I have no excuse. I know this is what I'm going to use it to at least contribute to social change. But I know these folks used their craft to do that, and they had no American passport to lean on that said, you know, at least you have a base of this, you know, very developed country in this area.
Right.
And so what excuse do I have? And I just realized at that moment I didn't have an excuse. And I wanted to tell, I knew, I just identified what my heart wanted, which was to tell African stories from the African female perspective.
And it just hit you.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was also accumulation. It was also like the sense of lack I felt around that. Why is there so little of that happening? Why are there so few of those stories being told? When I look for them, I can't find them. You know,
well, what's it's, that it's, about? It's like an artistic mandate that you discovered that you have to protect your art once mm-hmm. you find that thing. And it almost seems like you found something and you didn't want to let it go. Is that how it felt?
It felt right. I mean, when you do that, I think it feels, if you feel right. And I think that developed a bit of a muscle in me that I have to keep, you know, developing. But it's that muscle that says, you know, you are actually, as my manager says it, you are the CEO of Danai Gurira Inc. You know, we follow what becomes clear to you as to what direction things need to go.
Yeah.
And so I think that's where I started to develop that confidence in the fact that, or understand that that was something that only could come from me.
Right. So did you ever question yourself, like, where am I going to go with this? Am I going to act? Am I going to write? Or did you even put limits on it?
See, those limits are very Western. The way the African approaches dramatic arts is often you're just a storyteller. So you like John Connie. You write, you perform, it's all the same. You sing if you need to. You dance if you need to, but it's all storytelling.
There's not the delineations. So for you, you didn't, even though you were in a, obviously you're in, at Tisch, you know, you're taught to specialize, I'm sure, but you
yes.
come from culturally right. someplace else.
Well, the beauty of that particular program was that we were doing everything in there. And we were getting very classically trained, but we also were getting very trained in commedia dell'arte. We were getting very trained in things that were taking, that, you know, singing, whatever. There were tons of, we had yoga class. There were lots of ways that she was crafting us to be fully, you know, very fully formed artists, not just artists who are going to, as she would put it, sit by the phone and wait for it to ring. You've got to know how to get up and create some work.
So what does that do for your confidence? I mean, where does that put you when you're out and you're auditioning with a big group of actors, you know, trying to get television shows or films? It probably puts you in a different mindset, I would think.
Well, you know, I think the Tisch actor was renowned for being considered more raw.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we loved Chekhov and Shakespeare and Shaw, and we did a ton of that. But we were kind of the more unexpected kind of raw artist who'd walk in the door, and it was like, you didn't know what we were going to do, because we were going to find the thing. We were going to look for the thing. We had a zest for seeking out that really exciting thing in the craft, and
yeah.
not just delivering what's expected. And I had to go through a big kind of moment of a bit of a, you know, we all have to have them. If you don't have one of these in grad school, you didn't go through a good program. If you don't have a good ass breakdown, okay, you didn't go to grad school, or you need your money back.
Breakdown is part of the program.
The breakdown is part of the program, though they don't force it on you, but they do discombobulate you enough to get to that thing. You know, what is your thing? Everyone's thing is different.
Okay, so you have the epiphany in undergrad,
yeah,
and then you have the massive breakdown in grad
yes.
school.
Yes, and I'm talking to my parents, like, maybe I'm not meant to be an actor. I don't know. My dad's like, you know, my dad's an academic, so he's like, but you have the talent. You know, you pursue what you love. You know, and it doesn't, you know, that's not very, it's beautiful, because it's not very common, you know, when you're coming from where my parents come from, people want their kids to be more and more stable as the generations go by.
Right.
And they were like, go after what you love. Don't go after what's guaranteeing you a paycheck. And that's, you know, I'm thankful for that, because a lot of kids I knew did not have that in their homes, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, be a doctor, a lawyer, or a banker.
Here are your options.
Exactly.
Door number one,
take your pick.
Door number two.
So I went through this whole phase of just not knowing, but then it really became clear that actually all that I knew I was supposed to do as an artist and be and tell African women's stories, it was still all there. It was really me becoming, really shedding any need to please people. And that's what the pursuit, the whole breakdown was about. Include anybody.
So
anybody.
So you have this breakdown, and it helps you to become more of who you are.
Yeah, right? And so that by the point that you were talking about, I was able to put out who I was to everybody. I wasn't like holding anything back to keep people happy.
Okay, so let's talk about Eclipsed a little bit, because what's amazing to me is that the entire thing started with a photograph, right?
Mm-hmm.
So describe this picture.
It's basically, it was right in 2003. It was right when there was the war was at its absolute and utter height in Liberia. And these women who were rebel soldiers in the war, but they were cool, they were like dressed like cool jeans and little slinky tops, and their hair was all did. They had like berets to the side and massive AK-47s. And they were Black African women. And I said, I have never seen this in my life. I was like, what is this? I have got to learn this story.
So you decided you see this photograph and you're like, I'm going to research this and I'm going to go to West Africa. Because it's almost like you approach the writing of this play like an academic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like through research rather than...
I guess that's where it comes in, you know?
Yeah.
That's where the everything melds, because I grew up in an academic home. I was going to get a PhD. I was a researcher throughout high college. And for me, I have to know, I have to learn, I have to be totally immersed in the world and in the circumstances and experiences and the nuances of a culture. So I knew I had to go there. I could not understand people who write things about places they've never been. It's possible, but I can't do it.
I wouldn't know how you would. I mean, the way this play, we should say, it's four women who were the sex slaves of a commanding officer during the rebel uprising in Liberia.
Mm-hmm.
And these women are sort of almost four archetypes of that I was able to relate to, having never been to Liberia, having no knowledge of the war. I felt like by the time I finished this play, I knew these women.
Liberia was just a completely new world. I mean, people, that's why it amazes me. And maybe because that's why I'm so connected to the idea of dispersing all the myths around Africa, because it is such a diverse continent. And Liberia was just recovering from the war when I got there. You know, it was, at the same time, such an amazing people who were very, very willing to embrace my hope to connect with them that deeply. And I just met some of the most astounding women there, like literally the coolest, most ballsy, most fascinating, dominant, powerful women I've ever met are in Liberia.
Well, what's amazing to me is how relatable it is to a white guy who grew up in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the true accomplishment of the play, is that it does prove that you can take a story about a culture and a place and an event that I have no connection with and make me see it just as other human beings. But did you wonder when you were writing this, is this going to connect?
I mean, I think that's always been the goal, you know, for me, because I sit in between these two cultures.
Right.
And I see them both as deeply relatable to me. So I always marvel at how it feels like, you know, I'll watch someone take in information or share information about the continent, and I'm like, is that how you saw it? You know, it's like I'm seeing something so different. There has to be a way of breaking that and creating a bridge where it's very clear the similarities and the humanity shared and the life perspectives shared between these two seemingly different peoples. And so that's very much a thing that I pursue, is making my work accessible and authentic at the same time.
Right.
And I guess that's probably the benefit of the fact that I know America so well and I know the continent
pretty well.
Well,
you're in such a unique position to be able to speak to both sides.
Right. And I think that is something that I just sort of had to accept and go for, you know? And so the
idea... Does it feel like a responsibility to you? Rather than the idea of, oh, what should I write about? I want to be a writer. I want to be an artist. You know, does it give you a different responsibility than someone who says, oh, I want to be an actor because I have a love of acting? Or
yes and absolutely no. There is there's a scripture I love that says, to whom much is given, much is expected. And so I kind of, that's a part of my sort of mantra in my head, because I know I do take on a lot because I've received a lot. And so I feel like I need to pour out a lot. And so that's something that, you know, I guess that fits into what you're saying in terms of my yes to your question. But the no to it is that I really enjoy it. So the idea of finding characters that I know, like I want people to watch, eclipsed and kind of feel like that little hovel they live in kind of feels like home by the end of it. Like oh, I can hang there.
Yes.
That's home. And like, you know, when it gets all bare at the end, they're like, oh no, what happened to our little fire pit here? You know what I mean? Like, I kind of want, my goal is to bring that in, but that's gotta be a source of joy for the writer. Otherwise, it comes across didactic. You know, it's got to be where I get lost in how I connect, you know, the very universal human complexities of a character to an audience that feels they're very separate from there. I have to find the joy in that sort of, you know, crafting and that sort of, you know, strategizing. You know, I have to find the joy in that and sort of get lost in it. Otherwise, it's going to look like a chore.
Right. Well, that's the key, right? How do you get lost in something and forget about how it's going to be received or whether it's going to be understood or whether it's going to be liked?
It's the joy in it is when, you know, that childlike, yeah, that childlike enjoyment where you want to go back and, you know, write and keep writing and you, oh my God, and you remember, you've realized that. And literally a lot of things come to me just as I write, like I'm writing and I'm like, oh, and I sort of hear the characters and it sort of starts to thread together, you know. And that's awesome to have that. And it takes a lot of work to get to that place. That's the thing. But once you're in that place, in that zone, it takes a lot of work to get to the zone. But once you're in the zone, I mean, it's sheer joy.
And when you're in the zone, does it feel like almost you're a vessel to receive?
Exactly. And the whole goal as being an artist, I think this, you know, goes into acting too. But as a writer, the whole goal is to become, I always say, I'm always trying to become a worthy enough vessel for the story to come through me. And so that's where all the work comes in initially, is to get to that place where the story is trusting of you as a vessel.
So it has a life of its own.
Exactly, because a lot of times you can come up with an idea. And we see this where you're like, that was like, it was a great idea, but it didn't synthesize into a living narrative.
Right.
It was held as an idea.
Or too many people got a hold of it.
Too many people got it. Too many opinions got in the
committee.
Pot. Exactly. And you feel that. It's like you can't, you can say, okay, so this was a great idea initially. And then.
Yeah.
And so I think the vessel part of it is you have to get to the point where the great idea breaks into something you didn't expect. An idea is yours, then the story actually, you become the stories, you become its vessel, and the idea kind of fades out.
Right. Like your initial impulse for doing it, that's almost got to go away.
Yeah, it's got to. And that's when you know something's happening, and something's alive. Because it's that question of something becoming alive. I remember one time my last play that was, I guess, early 2016, was in rehearsal off Broadway, Familiar. And I was like, we'd done a production of it already, and you know, it was such a difficult birth, as I call it. It was like my most difficult birth, and it was totally about like stuff I really know quite intimately, because it's connected to family and first generation in America and all that. And I was just like so struggling with it, largely because there was so much story I could tell. How do you bring that into something deeply muscular for 2 hours worth of an experience on stage? So that was very, it was like this one, this pastor I love talks about like how there's this like, you know, the Michelangelo looked at this massive piece of marble and everyone, it was kind of flawed. It had like a crack in it or something. And everyone's like, ugh, don't know what to do with that thing. And he worked at it. And then out comes the David. And they said, how did you do that? He said, I just chipped away at everything that wasn't David.
In one sentence, you describe something that's so hard to do.
It's very hard to do, but I that became my goal. It was like, I'm going to find my David. There is a David in here, and I'm going to find him, whatever he is. And so that was like this thing that I held on to through that very difficult process. And I remember one time I was in a rehearsal, and I was like, okay. And I said to my director, I said, okay, let's just let everybody go home early. You know, and I was like, everybody go, I just needed to go back in because I wasn't feeling entertained enough. And that's kind of my gauge. I'm like, I don't feel, this is not it and it's not there and I'm not going to try and slip it in as being there because I don't feel enticed by it. And I'm going to be my own gauge right now because I know that I haven't been enough of a vessel for this story yet because I'm not even engaged yet enough. For my pleasure, for my satisfaction.
Yeah.
So I said, clear the room. I gotta go back in.
What part of storytelling is still mysterious to you?
I think like everything coming together, you know what I mean? From character to plot to, you know, overarching dramatic action, all those things sort of merging into that experience where you really feel like this communion has happened between audience and story, you know, that you couldn't, and the beauty of it is that you just can't predict it. You just can't.
Even when it's your own work, you can't predict it.
You have no idea. Like, I always got freaked out the end of the first act of Familiar, because people were cracking up so hard, and they were meant to, but it was like, that amount of laughter really freaked me out. It was a good thing. But it just was so overwhelming for me. I was like, it's working? They're laughing? They're laughing really hard. The lights are coming up. They're still laughing. And I'd always just run out the theater. I can't tell you why. It was the mystery of it all for me. There was something in that to answer your question.
In seeing this thing that you birthed, and then here it is working on
people.
Yeah,
the thing that you write, you're like, I don't know where this is coming from. This might be a little crazy. And then you see that response. You see the sort of give and take of it. We give the story, they take it and receive it this way, they respond, and you're sort of in the midst of that, you know, that clinching moment. It is mysterious.
Wow. I mean, I really like the idea that you don't have a distinction between the different forms of art that you've chosen to be involved in. You know what I mean? That you are a storyteller. When you're on The Walking Dead, you have a part in telling that story the same way as if you're sitting down and writing it. By having a larger purpose to your storytelling, does it take you out of your own head, your own self-criticism, a little bit more than if you were just focused on getting awards or getting the next big job?
Yes, it can. It can. Very much so. There has to. But you know, I don't get. Don't be fooled. I'm wretchedly neurotic sometimes. So, and I can be very hard on myself. Ability. I think of it like tennis. You know, I'm a big tennis fanatic. At not playing well, I was never good at it.
But it's a hard game.
Oh God, it's so hard. But the thing I adore about that sport is it's all, you're just watching two minds at work, and often half the time it feels like mind sport, because it's about how resilient you are after a bad play. Because no one's really won until they've won.
You look at these things as opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to be any kind of artist and be afraid to fail or to be... artists can easily take themselves out of... Or I should say it differently. People can take themselves out of contention by their own fear.
Right.
And what you're saying is failing. Everybody has fear, mm-hmm. but it's what you choose to do with it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that's what Nelson Mandela put it about courage, you know. It's not about the absence of fear. It's about doing things in the face of fear. And I definitely have had to hold on to that a lot. I mean, because of course, I mean, I used to get, you know, I created my first play, you know, from just performing it in front of people all the time and, you know, and putting it together and putting it out there, and this thing called free play we did at the end of grad school, and then all of a sudden, and then I put it out there over and over again, and then we're on an off-Broadway stage, and I'm putting it out, and then suddenly we get our own theater, and now we're really rolling, and all of a sudden I get stage fright. You know what I mean?
Really?
Like, and suddenly it's like, oh, no, Jesus, I have to go out there and do her, then her. Oh my God, then I gotta get to there. Like, it's this thing I created from scratch, and I performed a ton of times, and all of a sudden, you know, you're getting hit by a fear of going out on stage and creating that world again. And so it's not something you just kind of get rid of. You get better at like dispelling the sort of how strongly fear can hit you. Absolutely, and that has happened over years. But in terms of fear never coming, no, it's gonna come. It's a question about how you respond to it.
It's amazing, you know, talking about putting on your armor and guarding your epiphany. It doesn't ever get any easier, does it? Like, you still have to have your guard up. Like, at any moment, whatever it is inside of us that makes us want to do original, interesting things can also be the most terrifying thing in the world.
It should be. I mean, often the thing that you're called to do, or that you have a passion inside you to do, it's gonna be terrifying, and I believe in everyone's uniqueness. I believe everyone, you know, is designed with purpose and with something that they're they're only they can do the way they can do it, you know. And I believe about that for everybody, but there's so many things in the world that are going to try to distract us. Because you can actually allow yourself to be carried away with everything around you, or you can create your own ways of how you know to nurture what you want to nurture inside of you.
Yes, you could be the architect of your existence, or you can give that honor to somebody else. But if you give it away,
the world loses out because there's something inside of you that doesn't get to get birthed.
Right.
And that's something I can't, like every single stage of life, I have to relearn that lesson. There are new distractions and there are new callings.
Yeah, you never stop learning that lesson.
No.
Well, listen, this has been fascinating talking to you, and I can't wait to see what you do next. And just this week, digging into some of the work, like reading Eclipsed and going deeper into some of your work, I'm amazed how relatable you make the world, or how your storytelling has a way of shrinking the world to its core elements that we're all the same. And I just think what you do is fascinating. So thank you for coming on and
I appreciate that.
Talking to me.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Of course. Hey folks, that's our show for today. I was fascinated with Danai, and I have to admit, I had not watched The Walking Dead until I knew she was coming on the show. I have since done a deep dive into the futuristic zombie world of that show, and yes, I get it, I'm 7 years late to the party. But if you are too, check that work out. And of course, see Black Panther. And if you want to go really deep, do what I did, and go on Amazon and buy Eclipsed. Danai's play about sex slaves that takes place during the Liberian Civil War. It's a fascinating read. And speaking of fascinating reads, you know, you can read the Off-Camera magazine each week. That's right, for each guest, we make an Off-Camera magazine that you can get online at our store, offcamera.com. It's a great way to dive into the stories of these iconic artists. So if you haven't checked out the store, we have all the back issues there, and you can also get a digital subscription. Also, when you're there, check out the monthly subscription to our television show. That's right, Off Camera is not only a podcast, it's a television show. And for $4.99 a month, you can have access to our entire archive. That's 134 shows that you can watch on any device, anytime, as many times as you want. I encourage you to check it out. You can find us on social media. We are Off Camera Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And I am Sam Jones on Twitter and Sam Jones Pictures on Instagram. And if you want to drop me a line, I'm sam@offcamera.com. I want to thank everyone that helped out on the show today. Crawford Shippey, Nathan Shields, Michaela Galvin, Sasha Snow, Amy Jones, Kara Johnson, and Matt Davidson, who found out this week that his rabies vaccination is out of date. So heal up quick, Matt, and we're all pulling for you, buddy. And please join me next time when I sit down with rapper, actor, and author Rashid Lin, known worldwide as Common.
One thing that I really appreciate about being an artist that does speak to the times is that the music becomes less about you. You see something going on, you're like, man, it's bigger than me. Prince used to say it's powerful in songs when you don't hear the word I. And I think with a lot of the art that we're seeing going on right now, it's a we mentality.
The Grammy, Oscar, and Emmy Award winner is one T away from an EGOT, the Artistic Grand Slam of Awards, that has only been achieved by 12 people in history. But Common is not in it for the awards. He's in it for the opportunity to tell his truth and hopefully help create real change with his art. We talk about the power of hip-hop, how artists need to be leaders, and how being a mama's boy has worked out pretty well for him. See you next time, Off Camera.